I wanted to talk a little bit about open licensing and and some various quirks in it, which I've learned a lot about from you. But also I just wanted to just generally talk to you about how you got into the open world in the first place. And just, you know, also to call out that you've been known you for a few years now, a really great friend, really great guy. There's very few people I found to be so enthusiastic about open and uncompromising, but also at the same time, curiously practical. And I've gained a lot from just talking to you about this stuff, but also you've helped me a lot in the past as well. So thank you for that. So let's talk about a little bit about how you got into this open world in the first place.
The entry point is that I was writing my master's at the University of the Providers Rand, my master's of law, and at the same time I was working in a law clinic helping poor people, ordinary people, with very practical problems of being evicted or losing their jobs.
This is South Africa.
In Johannesburg, South Africa. And a number of people told me that these two things didn't mix. I had sort of pick one. And I believed at the time, and still do, that what we need to do when it comes to the regulation of technology, which is, I guess, what I was interested in with internet law, it should benefit poor people and marginalized people. And particularly, I was interested in how the internet could increase access to knowledge for people. And an important document for a lot of South Africans is something called the Freedom Charter. It says the doors of learning and culture shall be open to all. And that's really, whenever I hear people saying, well, they have this or that motivation behind openness, for me, that's it.
When was that document created?
That document was created in 1955.
Wow.
By a congress of all people from all races in South Africa. And that document then inspired resistance until the transition to democracy.
Ah, so this is a this is an apartheid era document.
Yes, and what happened is white and Indian and coloured, as we used to call it in South Africa, and black people came together and wrote this document, this vision of a country that they aspired to, and then that vision sustained people through some very dark years, and then we transitioned to democracy, but that's not enough. You actually need a truly inclusive society that gives opportunities and benefits to everybody.
Kind of amazing. I mean, those were dark days that they had this very concrete vision.
Yeah.
That even persists and possibly can't even get fully realized post-apartheid and in a democratic era.
Yeah. And that's, of course, because one of the shifts where power takes place, it no longer just resides in the state. It resides in these institutions outside of the state, these treaty bodies like the World Trade Organization, which set up rules which all developing countries have to adhere to, but which then present challenges. And so one of my other inspirations at the time was Access to Medicines Movement, in which there's this technology, pharmaceutical breakthroughs, but it wasn't being made available to the people who needed it. And the claim was this is sort of purely a technocratic matter as opposed to a matter of justice. And I wasn't convinced. Then at a conference at Stanford University, I had an opportunity to meet a man called Larry Lessig. He invited me to work with him.
What year was this?
2002, I met Larry and he introduced me to a woman called Heather Ford. And together we decided to start Creative Commons South Africa. To do that, I would write versions of the Creative Commons licenses, which had been created in the United States, which would suit South African law. And I did that. And I did all that work as a volunteer. And I remember one particular evening when I was back in South Africa, where with the second version of the licenses that I had to produce, you had to put them in XML and then send them to an XML parser. And I hadn't been trained to write XML. And I was trying to write these lessons, trying to get it right, and it was kind of 8:30 at night, I should be getting home, and thinking, this is really tough. But later on, and it's depending on whether we think these statistics are reliable, I don't think they are, apparently these licenses have been reused something like 300,000 times.
Right.
So let's assume it's a third of that, or even a tenth of that. 30,000 times, that's a massive impact to have for a few hours of volunteer labor.
Yeah, so that is an amazing impact. One of the other things that occurs to me about this part of your journey within openness is that the it wasn't, you had to translate these, not in the sense of translating the language, although that's also potentially true, but to jurisdiction, right? So the Creative Commons ideas born in America didn't just seamlessly pass through boundaries. You actually had to translate them into that context, which is why they needed you as a lawyer to do that.
Yes, and lots of countries had these projects, and then there were later on there were concerns about the compatibility of these different licenses. So then there was another process in which the international licenses were created, and all the legal teams that had created their country licenses then sort of signed off that these international licenses covered all the bases. And I think in many ways that although it was a sort of confusing process, first you port to all these countries and then you sort of try and settle on a single standard, I think that it was actually a really good process, because what it meant was we didn't have an international standard that wasn't truly international, something that had, let's say, just been created in the US. We had an international standard that had been scrutinized and argued about by something like 100 lawyers from different countries. And so when you got an agreement to the standard, it really was a profound agreement.
And so from there, I mean, as I understand it, you had a widening interest in openness in general.
Yes, and I had tried previously, even before I had encountered Creative Commons, to run Linux. I found it very hard. The UIs weren't easy for people like me. But later on, I started to use Ubuntu Linux. I'd obviously been impressed with Firefox and used Firefox since I first used the internet. As I learned about open source, and in particular about copyleft, I saw it as a brilliant hack.
Could you explain copyleft a little bit?
Yeah, so copyleft is when you take a copyright license and you distribute whatever it is. It could be software, it could be a photograph, could be a text, under a copyleft license. So the classic software copyleft licenses are the GPL, the General Public License, or with Creative Commons, it would be Creative Commons Share Alike. And you say, anybody can copy this. Anybody can change this. Anybody can distribute this. But if you change it and you distribute it, you must distribute those changes under the same license. Because when somebody changes it, then in copyright law, they've created what's called, depending on the jurisdiction, an adaptation or a derivative work. And they get copyright too. So what it does is it creates this kind of incremental pattern in which multiple people can improve something and then they share their improvements and improve something and share their improvements. It's a cyclic, cumulative thing. And all of the big open projects have used copyleft. So Linux, thousands of people have contributed and it uses copyleft. Wikipedia, possibly millions of people have contributed and it uses copyleft. So it is certainly the way in which people have successfully created these massive cumulative works.
Right. So you started to get more interested in this area as and with regard to the software.
Yes. And I began to get more queries as well. So I started working with some more technical people who were increasingly interested in how to use different licenses.
So on the way, you came up with this notion of OpenLox.
Yes, so OpenLox inspired by the way that copyleft locks something open. So lawyers tend to lock things closed. They tend to use copyright licenses, for example, to prevent all uses but a tiny sliver. And copyleft, the idea is, well, we'll lock it open. We'll make sure that you can do whatever you want except lock it down. But I began to wonder how we could do this at the institutional level. What about a company? How can we make sure a company continues in the future making things open? And so an open lock is a rule within the company documents which requires that all the products that get distributed are put under an open license. Sometimes it specifies which open licenses or specifies that the software must be distributed under something compatible with the open source definition. I've never had someone do it require the free software definition, but they could do that too. And then that rule can't be easily changed. So that means that either it requires a special majority, say shares, 80% of the shares, or it might require a single shareholder with a golden share, but they're the only person who can agree. And so this is really important because lots of companies set out wanting to be open, but down the line they have to take money from other investors, or perhaps the leadership changes and people aren't as bought into the mission. And at that point in time, it needs to be not impossible. These things can always be overcome in some way or another, but really, really not an easy option to just collapse on openness.
Right. And this was inspired by the golden share idea, which was an established concept.
Yes. So in, I think, the 70s, the British government privatized British Petroleum. And they retained, at least for a while, a golden share. So they didn't get a lot of money. They didn't have a big shareholding than a majority, but they could veto certain actions by the company. So golden shares then, together with something called a mission lock, which says the company has a particular mission and it mustn't sort of try and start doing something new. And also something what's called a founder lock. So it might be that you can't get rid of the founder of the company, you know, without 95% of the shares or without a golden shareholder agreeing. That could be the founder sometimes.
Right.
So those were existing mechanisms that were already in use for companies to remain trying to engage in their social purpose. Then I came with the open lock to join those as a potential way of ensuring companies stay on mission.
Right. So the idea within this, a mission-orientated, not-for-profit world, which I believe is mostly the people you work with,
yes,
who are producing some sort of intellectual property, then they can ensure that not only do they license that in an open way, with an open license, so to speak, but also that all other products and going forward into the future, nothing can happen to that, put it in jeopardy without undoing this other legal structure, which is embedded within the host organization itself.
That's right.
Right.
And that can be super important, not just in terms of staying on mission, but in eliciting trust from others. It might be that it's certain investors won't invest money unless they're sure that everything will remain open. It could be that you want to ask for contributions from a community, and not only they want their contributions to be under an open license, but they want to make sure the company won't change direction and produce a closed version or perhaps abandon the open project easily. And so that can elicit a lot of trust from particular partners, investors, contributors to software, even in some contexts, customers will be like, well, I'm only actually going to start, you know, buying into this thing if I know it's going to stay open. And so it's really a mechanism that builds trust, because in the broader world of thinking about trust, one way is to bind yourself. It's a way of demonstrating that you're willing to sacrifice something, and therefore others will trust you more.
Right. Interesting. So OpenLocks now is it's a formal structure that you've created.
So we've seen OpenLocks in a South African company, in a Hong Kong company, an English company, and an American company. Each time the language is going to be slightly different and the mechanism might be slightly different. On the Shuttleworth Foundation site, there is a precedent. So there is language that can be used and has been used. But it's more this sort of concept, and you might mix things up a little bit. You might have that it can only be changed when there's a majority of shareholders, or a special majority, or when a golden shareholder is persuaded. There are other ways of doing it. You could add, which I haven't seen done yet. You could say, well, you can make the change, but it takes 6 months to take effect. So then there's time for a community to protest and point out it's a bad idea,
right,
or simply to sort of desert the company that's no longer going to be open.
Which is a useful mechanism should somebody wish to sort of ambush,
yeah,
the organization or its constituency, just to slow it down.
Yes. So when there's nothing like that in place, there have been a couple of instances that I've witnessed in the scholarly world where what was purportedly open repository overnight announced that it had been acquired by a big commercial player.
Right. So this is a good way to protect against what the community or the stakeholders would consider bad faith acquisitions.
Yes.
Right. Interesting. Can I ask you some basic stuff about copyright?
Yeah.
First of all, I think many people have an understanding that, that Creative Commons is outside of copyright, right? Can you explain just a little bit very briefly why that's not the case?
The place to start with copyright is people often confuse it with trademark and patent. They think you have to register copyright somewhere, and they're quite anxious that they want to register their copyrights and obtain some control. But copyright's really quite an astonishing thing. It gives you, and in fact burdens you, with exclusive control of any creative work you make. When I say burdens you, it's because if you want to disburden yourself, if you wanted a whole lot of other people to freely copy your work, that's not the legal default. The legal default is that they can't. If you want to give permission, it requires an explicit act. It burdens you with giving everybody clear legal permission, because otherwise they run a risk that they're infringing copyright. So what Creative Commons does is it says, well, there's plenty of people who want to share their artwork, their photographs, their software with other people. Copyright imposes on those people, because their work cannot be freely shared by other people, because anybody else who wants to freely use it needs to be sure that they have clear permission to do that. Because if they don't have that explicit clear permission, so the default is everything is default closed under copyright. Creative Commons comes along and says, we'll give you an easy way to license all the world. It's clear, all the people who want to use your work can rely on it. So they know they're not infringing as long as they stick with the license. But it works by essentially being a copyright license, and thus giving people all these permissions which they don't have without the license.
Right. So the notion is that you can't escape copyright, but copyright gives you the ability, if you are the copyright holder of something, to then confer rights downstream to other people. And Creative Commons and open source licenses basically just give you a template that just makes that's transmission of the content and the ability to change it just easier.
Yes.
Right.
And so when Gandhi was in South Africa, he ran a printer, a publishing house, and some of the books they disclaimed copyright, and it's unclear. Nobody litigated in those days whether those disclaimers were viable or not.
Interesting. But he was a lawyer, wasn't he?
Yes, exactly.
So did he have a good argument for it?
He didn't believe that knowledge should be locked down. But the disclaimer is just a short sentence. And so it's unclear whether under the 1910 Imperial Copyright Act, which applied in South Africa at the time, whether would have been a valid relicensing or dedication to the public domain. Whereas, by contrast with what Gandhi did, the Creative Commons licenses, the general public license, have all been tested in courts. They've been declared to be valid copyright licenses, which means the risk for the person reusing the thing is zero. They know that they have clear, legally strong permissions. If the person who'd put the thing under the, let's say it's the GPL, later on wants to change his or her mind and try and sue people, they can't. That license is now protecting the person who reused.
Mm. So it's now robust.
Yes.
But that's kind of fascinating. So South Africa's kind of played kind of an important role in this whole area of free licensing.
Well, almost no one knows about that. Mm. And yet there's this sort of moment in time in the past in which there was this. Even further back, medieval monks believed that everybody who participated in reason, in learning, could only do so by participating in the mind of God. So to make claim of, you could claim to be the author of a book, but to claim that this gave you some kind of ownership was blasphemous.
Oh, because you're claiming that something of the ownership of God's mind.
Yes. Similarly, some Buddhist traditions in China, you never asked for attribution. You never put a name on a sacred text, because you were just transmitting what the Buddha had transmitted to you. And so to kind of try and interpolate yourself in the way would have been, again, wrong.
Right. Fascinating. Just to go back to the simple mechanics of copyright. So you cannot have an asset that's been created that doesn't have a copyright holder. Is that true? Or is this in situations where you can create something and not have a copyright owner?
So this differs from country to country. Copyright law is actually far more similar than most other legal issues. So if we were to talk about property law in Lithuania versus property law in England versus property law in South Africa, those are going to be very different systems each time. But copyright's pretty similar because we have two agreements, the Berne Convention and the Trade-Related Aspects of Intellectual Property Treaty, which require a lot of similarities between countries. And what they require is that as soon as somebody creates a creative work which is in a material form, so it could be writing it down, it could be recording it, it could be drawing it in the mud, then there's copyright in it. And no one else may copy it or make it a work from it for that person's lifetime, and then, depending on the jurisdiction, 50 years or 70 years. So it's quite an astonishing thing. I've done a little doodle here while we're talking, and I get automatic copyright, not just here where I'm sitting, the country I'm sitting, Lithuania. Immediately, I now have a right in, let's say, France or Australia, somewhere I've never been. And so it arises automatically. Now, by original, we don't mean it has to meet some kind of creative threshold. It just mustn't be copied from somebody else.
Right.
So it's a pretty low threshold.
Right, right. So then if you, because of the conventions, pretty much wherever you go, you create something, then you are the copyright owner, and then you may infer downstream rights through templates like Creative Commons or through software licenses.
Yes.
So is it also true that these are irrevocable?
Yeah, so all the open source, free and open source software licenses are irrevocable except for breach. So what that means is that whoever licensed the work upstream, now it might have been adapted and then adapted again and then adapted again and then adapted again and then adapted again. If someone in that chain decides they want to no longer license their work, they don't have to license any new work. They don't have to provide that work to anyone. So they don't have to keep it up on their GitHub channel or something. But all the copies that people have can continue being reused under that license, and it's irrevocable.
Right.
Now, if as an individual I've received something under a license and I breach the license, then I can cease to have permission. So the way some licenses are written are that if I don't comply, then I automatically no longer have a license. So now I'm copyright infringing. But that license hasn't been revoked for the rest of the world. It's just me.
Right, because you're a baddie.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and because I needed, the law is, I need permission to do certain things under copyright.
Right.
I was given that permission, provided I did certain other things. I've not done those certain other things, so therefore I don't have permission.
So how crazy can that be? What kind of things, do people go? Because there was a lot of discussion in the free software world for a while, and it may have come back again. I haven't really been tracking it too much about, okay, yes, we're going to use this license for the software, but the weapons industry cannot use the software.
So the most interesting recent one has been a movement in China to say that where companies require people to work 12 hours a day, 6 days a week or something, that any company that does that cannot use the software. That kind of license is not regarded as compliant with the Free Software Foundation's definition, nor the Open Source Initiative's definition.
But you can still do it.
Oh, anybody can write any license they want.
Right. So you can put any kind of bonkers kind of requirements into it.
Yes. So I've seen no military use. I've seen no nuclear use. And I found those licenses. I went looking for them because I wanted to. I was writing about how futile those kinds of licenses are. So every now and then someone comes up with a license in which they want to not just enforce freedom to use and to reuse, but some other perspective. And no doubt they might feel very passionate about it. but in practice, no one ever uses the licenses.
That's because it just looks too troublesome? Or?
Well, and because it's then incompatible with everything else.
Right.
Because
yes, of course.
If you choose the open environment license and you that you make up, and you don't want your software used at all with oil, but now I add another one, nuclear, well, are ours compatible? Or does our open license have to say it can't be used for oil or nuclear or war?
Right.
Or by male chauvinists or by... And many of these things are almost impossible to ascertain where the line is. You know, can we tell... What is a military use? That's something which is non-trivial in legal terms. And because it's non-trivial, that means there's massive uncertainty if anybody wants to use the license. So it defeats the original idea, which was to give people clear permission. You haven't given clear permission. So then people won't use it because they're afraid because you haven't given clear permission.
Interesting. And then that also sort of touches a little bit on trademarking a little bit. Because I know I've been to a few Wikimanias, for example, and there is an interesting how... you know, Wikipedia very happy for the content to be reused in whatever situation, but not very happy if you use the Wikipedia branding without permission. So I mean, why in this open culture world is trademark one of the only palatable defensive intellectual property tools?
Because trademarks are actually consumer protection. So trademarks start off when you have medieval guilds who mark, for instance, that steel came from Sheffield. Now, if anybody else claims their steel comes from Sheffield, firstly, they have to actually have a mark on the steel, and that's sort of hard to do. You have to have their logo and so on. Then that person's engaged in a kind of a fraud. And because the consumer needs to know what is the origin of these goods.
So just going on to back to software licensing for a second, and I know, which is was surprising to me at first, that you're not so keen on very permissive licenses, which I've found quite interesting. But can you sort of unpack that a little bit?
Well, recall my motivation in the beginning.
Right.
I want people, especially poor people, especially people in Africa, to have knowledge, to have software, etc. And so the more things that are open, the more likely they are to have that knowledge. A permissive license says, I am making this thing available so that anybody can do what they want with it, including taking a version of it, which they change, etc. And then they can lock that version down. So as a consequence, their version is now closed. And so their version is not available to the rest of the world. And so there are fewer closed things. Whereas copyleft requires that person, if they're going to distribute their version, to make it open and make it available to all the world. Now, there are arguments sometimes for copyleft, I mean, for purely permissive licenses. On that note, by the way, you should consider re-licensing, even if you want to be permissive, with the Blue Oak Council license. This is a very new permissive license. But it is, in drafting terms, in plain language terms, superior to the BSD and the MIT. I also have found, over quite a number of years of working with people with open source software, that where there are sometimes cases to use a permissive license, in most cases it doesn't make sense, because competitors can take your work, produce a proprietary version without having done any, made any contribution whatsoever, and in some, in many places, that can be a very difficult situation. It's not necessary to make licenses permissive in order to make them open. It's not necessary to give permission to make work proprietary, except perhaps if you already know there's somebody who will not use your work unless they can make a proprietary version, and there's some value in them doing that. You reach more people. You're a small software company. They're a behemoth, and somehow you think it's worth reaching many more people, even if it makes them money. The other piece is often when people have GPL software and they come to sell, then there's something that people want to buy, which is the ownership in open source, so they can avoid putting their work under the GPL. But when you come to try and sell permissive software, or a company that whose only asset is the software, then it's worth nothing. And right. So I specifically remember one client who I won't mention the name, where he was told by the people purchasing his company they would have had to pay him a couple of million more if they had to buy the copyright as well as some of the other assets.
But couldn't you at that moment change the license since you're the copyright owner?
Yeah, but they've downloaded under the permissive license.
And it's irrevocable.
Irrevocably, all the software. So then what are you going to add? How much are you going to rewrite the program?
Right, or you delay them.
Yeah.
And keep writing.
That's right.
Right, interesting.
So my view on this is that if there is a clear reason for using a permissive license, you should use one, but otherwise you should not. You should use a copyleft license, because usually you can relicense. So if you've got a contributor license agreement that allows you to do so, you can relicense under it.
Right. So, you mean like run several different licenses off the same asset?
Yes. And of course, if you've got a more restrictive license and a less restrictive license, then people might go for the less restrictive license. But if you have, let's say, had things GPL'd for 5 years, and then you encounter now the need to relicense maybe only one component, maybe multiple components under a permissive license, you can do that, the GPL. And that can be a very powerful way of generating revenue, which doesn't at all undercut making it available to the rest of the world, because it's just their fear of putting their improvements, or that it'll somehow taint their software. So sometimes there's an almost neurotic fear of using of GPL, that it'll contaminate everything. I've heard someone say this from a big tech company: you've got to stay away from copyleft, it'll contaminate everything. And there aren't any actual cases where, you know, you used GPL thing and suddenly everything you earned was copyleft. There's specific instances, and if you have a competent lawyer, he'll be able to help you figure out when it is and when it isn't.
So this relicensing, is that something you have to anticipate in the open locks?
Yes.
Okay. So it all has to be one system. You have to have thought this through.
Yeah, you have to thought this through. And you might not have thought through that we will definitely relicense, but you need to have kept the option open.
Right, right.
And so, for instance, if you said in your open lock, any open source initiative definition compatible license, well, there's a list of those, but you also can work it out from first principles, from reading the definition and looking at the license.
Right.
And you start off with a GPL, then at a later stage, you could shift to a more permissive license.
Right, fascinating. So you're quite an innovator in this space, and also, I have to say, one of the few people I found that can explain very complicated concepts of intellectual property to me, and also with a sensibility that that resonates with what people in this sector are trying to achieve. What's of interest for you now within this, you know, given that you've been involved in many innovations and supporting people in the sector, what are the kinds of things that are of interest to you now?
Well, I'm seeing two things happening, which are the next sort of generation of issues. One is concerns about privacy. So this is not around software so much. It's around data, although, of course, software which analyzes data, the kind of software which is created by machine learning models, is becoming increasingly important. So with data, we've generally, people in the open source movement have generally been making data open. And we said that we do want to protect privacy, but it was relatively easy to identify those times that we would take data out to identify privacy. But we now live in a different world in which data that's been anonymized can sometimes be de-anonymized. People can engage in an inference attack. And so now it's more difficult. It's more challenging. And so there is an initiative from the Linux Foundation for software and for data, a license which purports to prevent, it says people can't use, who use this, agree not to de-anonymize any data that's been anonymized. And So that's one way of trying to do things in this particular world. There are other ways that people are also trying to protect, solve that same problem. And I think that the licensing is only one piece. There's a sort of idea that you won't give people the whole data set. You'll have an API they can query. There's what's called the mathematical way of, well, exactly how much data do you give? You sort of not just not have some data available in a database, which will make an inference attack harder.
Can you explain inference attack?
So an inference attack is where we take so perhaps we have some innocuous piece of information like my zip code, which connects to my name, and then we anonymize sort of the fact, but we still list number of South Africans in this zip code, and then from there you might be able to figure out pretty quickly, white male South Africans in the zip code, that's me,
right? So it's by putting data sets together that don't necessarily have a relationship, but help you identify individuals.
Yes. And so they'll have one kind of relationship, zip codes, and then you can put them together and then re-identify particular individuals. So one would involve a data set which does identify an individual, and the other would be sensitive data.
Interesting.
Which doesn't identify individuals, but can be made compatible.
So how do you stop that?
Well, so one way is by not giving people the full access to the anonymized data set. They query through an API. Another is through this license, which says, all right, we're letting you use this data set, but if you use it to identify someone, then you are in violation.
Oh, that's interesting. So you're actually future-proofing it against all these other scenarios that we haven't yet imagined, where people may... It's not that you're preventing the use of data and the munging of data together. It's the outcome that you're licensing against, the finding people. Oh, interesting.
And so, so this is one of the big challenges. Another is that this sort of claim that somebody owns the software in an algorithm which has been created, the algorithm's been created by crunching lots of data, well, by the algorithm processing repeated data sets. And this is the subject of a lot of debate right now in academic circles, because it hasn't yet come down to a case. But the concern is this: well, if I write code, it's pretty obvious. I wrote this line of code. Here we write a little bit of code, what we want the machine learning model to accomplish, and we certainly select a data set. So there's a lot of human intention involved. But the person involved doesn't write the lines of code and may not understand the algorithm. So the algorithm then is effectively a bunch of ones and zeros, which will produce a particular result. It'll recognize a picture of a cat. But the person who we see as the author doesn't necessarily understand that algorithm, doesn't know how it works. So how do we say that person is the author or the creator of this algorithm? We're looking at something that's... And then in turn, that algorithm can be used to create further things. So some algorithms have now been used to create abstract art. Some have been used to create music. And to claim that the person who initially set in motion the generation of this algorithm and then fed the algorithm, thousands of songs, which now have it producing something that's like that,
right,
is tenuous.
Mm.
It's the equivalent of claiming that if a photographer leaves a camera around and a monkey presses the button, then that the photographer has copyright.
Well, it's also something to do with the sort of the butterfly effect in a way.
Yes.
You change something and then there's all this downstream stuff, and how can you claim that you had created that?
And some artists are very unhappy with this. They want to claim that they are the creators, because they've deliberately sort of set this up for the, and there is a kind of art in which people, you know, don't look at the painting but throw paint over their shoulder. I don't think that those kind of exceptional performance pieces should alter the primary way we've thought about creativity and justified copyright. Because we've justified copyright by reference to two different theories. So the French, in particular, have the romantic author theory that copyright is some intrinsic part of your personality. So this is sort of hard to believe when someone has copyright in a desk calendar. Mm-hmm. But if the original theory was that an author would sort of bare their soul and that their novel is some part of their... Mm. In the Anglo-American world, we've tended to see things in more utilitarian terms. If we give someone exclusive rights, then he or she will have an ability to earn revenue, and so they can make more works. If we give Dickens copyright in his novels, then he can sell books and write more novels. But otherwise, he can only write novels in the evening when he's home from being a court reporter.
Right.
But now let's look at our AI work. We don't have this romantic author churning out things.
Right.
Where we have a machine churning it.
Right. And the utility is also gone.
Utility is also gone because if my algorithm can churn out 10,000 songs an hour, am I going to get, how much incentive am I getting for the Life Plus 50? Also,
Life Plus 50 means like copyright period plus 50 years.
The life of the author plus 70 years. Yes,
right,
either.
Right.
But at the same time, what it's also doing is giving immense power to somebody who owns some software to undercut all those musicians whose music they use to train the algorithm.
Oh, interesting.
So it's a way of taking their labor and their work and then turning it against them by saying, well, but I can now, I've got, you know, now I can produce 10,000 songs an hour. Try competing with that musician.
Well, that's interesting though, because isn't it actually just a argument about kind of speed? Because can you argue that what the algorithm is doing and what the human does is the same? They take in this input from past works and then they create something. The only difference is that the human's doing it slower.
No.
No.
Because I would say that the vast majority of artists and musicians mean something. That it's not just having heard another person play. They're putting their life experience, they're putting passion. And certainly that's what we believe makes good music and good art.
Oh, that's interesting, but that's quite an esoteric distinction. I mean, I subscribe to it, but I can see, like, how do you encase that in as an argument within law?
Well, because if the idea was we want to give a musician an incentive to make enough money so they can make more works, we've just taken that away.
Right.
Because one machine can now outcompete 1,000 artists.
Right.
Can put them all out of business.
Right.
So speed matters. Speed on its own can be a quantity. But it's not just speed we're talking about. It's the relative effort. And it's the fact that we'd be giving power not to people, but to the owner, probably a company, who could invest money in putting together this bot. And so we're not in a world where we're trying to reward artists. We're in a world where we're rewarding a venture capitalist.
Right. And rewarding artists is the original construction of the copyright.
Yes. Otherwise, why do we have it? Remember that copyright and patent and trademark are very unusual in our law in almost every country because we don't like monopolies.
Right.
We abolished monopolies. The statute of monopolies abolishes monopolies in England. It says we don't want these things anymore. We have competition law, antitrust law, to say, no, you can't have just even market power where you prevent people from competing with you. So intellectual property is this massive exception where we actually have a statutory monopoly And we've had the statutory monopoly, at least so the claim has been made, in order to enable artists to make a living. If that's no longer the case, then you know, then why have it? Then abolish it.
So are there lawyers on the other side saying, oh, actually...
The vast majority of people speaking about this are making arguments that because there's some human agency at the beginning of this process choosing, setting up the conditions for the machine learning model, choosing the training sets, you know, somebody owns this server on which the software runs, that this is sufficient. But the consequence for artists and musicians and even people who write software is going to be quite dramatic. Mm-hmm. And I don't think everybody's quite woken up yet to what this is going to mean.
Scary. Anyway, thanks very much. And once again, thanks to you for, you know, you've been a great friend, and I've learned a tremendous amount from you. So thank you.
It's my pleasure.